Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Network's Thinking Through the Trees. And I'm excited to welcome the program, Michael Chappie. Michael, how are you? And I have another special show for us. I continue to get these interesting guests. I mean, you know, every day I get interesting guests, from talking to Triple H this week about NXT to next week with, again, I guess, The Voice and a bunch of different shows. But I love always chatting with you, Michael. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic. So I'm excited. This is the story last week we were talking about, or 2 weeks ago, about The Sopranos. I streamed it for the first time this year, went through all the seasons, and I got hooked. And somehow I continue to get connected to people with The Sopranos. And I'm excited to welcome the program one of the founders of SopranoCon, Michael Mata. Michael, thanks for calling, and I appreciate you stopping by and to chat with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And you could tell us who else you have on the line and introduce this Soprano star, and then we'll get into how about SopranoCon.
Sure. So we have my good friend Federico Castelluccio, as most of you know, Furio Giunta from Sopranos.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Fantastic. We're glad to have you on today. Absolutely. So, Michael, I'm going to go right into the...
My pleasure.
I'm going to get right into SopranoCon. How did you come up with this idea? How did this come about? Again, I know we're on the anniversary, which is a phenomenal thing, which I didn't even know. Again, it took me 20 years to stream it, right? So tell me specifically how you came up with the idea of SopranoCon.
So great thing. It's the 20th anniversary. I'm glad you got to enjoy it. It's the 20th anniversary of The Sopranos, which is first aired. And I've been fortunate enough in the past to actually put on some events with the Soprano cast. That's where I met Federico Castelluccio the first time. And I have an event venue in Rhode Island. And I got a call from a guy who saw some of my photos online and saw some of the cast members. The last time I did it was with Vincent Pastore, Big Pussy, Federico Castelluccio, obviously Furio. We had Dan Grimaldi, which was Patsy Parisi, and we had Jason Serbone, which was Jackie Jr. And we had a great event, and it went over really well. And of course, everybody loves The Sopranos. I mean, who doesn't? It's the biggest show in history. And I reached out to this gentleman. His name is Dan Trader, and he's actually been curating for the last 10 years a social media group that's about 200,000 Soprano active members that are really diehard. And he had seen my photos online and asked me some questions in regards to putting on an event. And once I realized as an entrepreneur that he had this big audience, I knew that I had to get involved. So I jumped on board, and he had a partner. His name is Joe Fama. So that makes up the three of us. And he's actually owns a print company as well as does conventions. And the three of us spoke. I called Federico. I said, listen, I met these guys, and I think this is going to be something that we could do, and we're going to make it big. And hence, Sopranos Con was born.
Wow. All right, Michael Chappie, go ahead with a question for Mike.
So what was the inspiration for the first one?
So I always had a love for The Sopranos. I always had a love for the show. It's a great show. I actually was introduced to the cast members through a company called Soprano Wines, in which I did my first event. It was called the New England Cigar Expo in the city of Providence, Rhode Island, and that's where I met Federico. And Federico and I actually have been talking for the last few years during the time where James Gandolfini actually was alive, and we were thinking about doing an event together with James where it would be like a Q&A, and we would travel all over the country. And unfortunately, you know, he actually passed, as all of you know, and it kind of went on the back burner. And when this opportunity came on board, it just made sense. So, you know, we went ahead and did it. I mean, 20th anniversary and still such a passion for the show. So it just made sense.
Federico, what did you think
Way about that.
Yeah, for sure. What did you say, Michael? I'm sorry.
I'm blown away by that.
Yeah.
James came to feet. If you guys would have did that, you would have sold out all over the country.
They're going to sell out anyways.
Yeah, the idea was to take it across the country.
Wow. So Federico, meeting Michael for the first time, when you met him, what'd you think with this whole process and what his mindset was with as probably one of the biggest Soprano fans?
Well, like Michael said, we met a long time ago, and I knew his personality. He's a very sharp guy. He's an entrepreneur, go-getter. And when he called me up, we've always had, great conversations about the Sopranos and other projects. And so when he called me up about this, I said, listen, this sounds really, really good because, it's the 20th anniversary and, everyone will love wanting to meet the actors, getting all the fans together. People are coming from all over the world, really. And I said, if you don't jump on this, somebody else is going to do it. So basically, they just went ahead with it. And I told them, listen, if you need any help getting some other actors on board and, just getting it started, I'd be happy to help you. And that's how I came on.
Wow. And when you got to meet the fans, Federico, doing the events with Michael before this, how great is it to hear the stories of how much they love the Sopranos and still love them?
It's fantastic. Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, look, we're getting new fans too right now. I mean, we're getting people that are streaming, the Sopranos on Netflix and other places that you can, that you can get it. Some of these people are like in their early 20s. It's like they probably weren't even born around that time or just barely. But it's great. It's really great to meet them, see the enthusiasm that they have for the show still. And of course, the original fans are still there 20 years later.
That's the great thing. And I wasn't one of them. And I think I was too busy pro wrestling to watch The Sopranos, or I was too cheap to get HBO. So we'll figure out which one. We'll figure out which reason why. But I mean, I just absolutely loved it. So go ahead, Chappie, with question for either Michael or Federico. You can choose.
Okay, Federico.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that you're a painter.
That's right.
What brought that on?
Well, I
started that at an early age.
Yeah, no, I'm a visual artist. I've been studying and I've been painting ever since I can remember. But I studied formally at the School of Visual Arts right out of high school on a full scholarship for painting, and I studied in New York City School of Visual Arts, and so. I've been, just painting professionally my whole, pretty much my whole life, and showing my work and selling it through galleries. I have quite a few different museums that own my work, including Yale University Museum.
Wow.
Sure. They have like 4 paintings of mine, and some museums in Europe as well, the Chigi Museum and just in Ariccia, right outside of Rome. Michigan State University, Kresge Art Museum. So I could go on. I mean, there's a lot of, private individuals that are luminaries, we could say, that own my work as well. I studied Italian and Italian 17th century Baroque and Renaissance. So my work is influenced by that period.
All right, Federico, let's talk about how you got the opportunity to audition for The Sopranos.
I in a very traditional manner, actually. I got a call from my agent. The first time I auditioned was for another role. And then about 6 to 8 months later, after bugging my manager every week, trying to figure out if there was a great role. I one of the things that I didn't want to do was do any kind of day player role or under five lines, And I felt, knowing that this show was so well written and the actors in it, top-notch actors, I mean, it was just so well done that I didn't want to waste it on just going in, knowing that it was a series, and going in for like a day player,
right.
Just like one shot and you're out. So I waited until this great opportunity came along, and the character was slated as Furio, Tony Soprano's cousin from Italy. So originally he was supposed to be Tony Soprano's cousin, but they changed it along the way, and they made him the Italian woman boss. Remember
yes.
Annalisa?
Yes.
And yeah. Played by Sophia Milos. Anyway, and she's also going to be at the Sopranos Con, which I haven't seen her in many years. It'd be great to see her again. So I'm losing my train of thought right now.
That's okay.
That happens every once in a while when I digress.
No, that's
but
great.
Yeah, I auditioned in a very traditional manner. Went in, and I had three auditions. First was for the casting director. Second was with all the producers and the director, Tim Van Patten. And the very third and last audition was sort of like a screen test with me and James Gandolfini. And all of the producers, HBO people were there, director, the casting director, Georgianne Walken. She was actually filming it. And I guess it was sort of an important character if they were doing that, because right after I finished my audition, they handed me a cold reading of it was a scene that takes place in Italy, and it said Naples, Italy on the heading. And I said, whoa, man, they going to Italy with this? This is interesting. So, so it turns out that, Furio was sort of a character that was important and, for the show.
I definitely believe it's important, and I remember it like it was yesterday, because it was almost a couple weeks ago. I was streaming it so about a month ago. So I feel like, hey, this is brand new. And that's what we got to love about streaming services and everybody getting interested. So Michael Motta's question. So I'm putting you on the spot, Michael, to come up with questions that you already know Federico more than we all know combined. But what kind of questions would you like in this follow up from what I first asked him?
As far as for Federico?
Yes, for Federico.
As you know, I do know him very well. I guess the question that I would ask is, Federico, obviously you got to work with the late, great James Gandolfini. Can you tell everyone, something, a memory that you had working with him that
sure.
You'll always remember?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I love talking about James, we call him Jim. His friends call him Jim. He was one of the most humble, down-to-earth persons I ever met, and had the pleasure and honor of working with. The very first time we worked together, I went up. It was about 3 a.m. when we finished, and I went over to him and I said, "Hey, James," and he said, "Please call me Jim," and so. I said, "Jim, I just want to tell you that I've been following your work for years." I said, I just love," and I started rattling off different things that he did in theater, when he was on Broadway, in A Streetcar Named Desire, and, in Black Box Theater, Tarantula's Dancing, all these,
wow.
All of these like things that, and he stepped back and he was like, he goes, "You're kidding me. You followed my work?" And, no, literally, it told me everything I needed to know about this man, that he was really, really humble and down to earth. He wasn't like a star and where it got to his head. He's just an average guy, man, just like me and you. And I'll never forget that. He treated everyone around him like they were his family. And he really cared about the people that he worked with. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read or heard about this, but when he wound up getting later on towards the latter seasons, he wound up getting a piece of the merchandising, and he sent, because it was a lot of money, he sent everyone a check for like $30,000.
Wow.
People that were working with him, sent. And then he gave gifts of watches to the people on the crew. So, he was really, he really cared about everyone.
Wow, that's great to hear that story, and I'm sure that the family loves to hear that. Go ahead, Michael, with your question. Chappie, with your question.
So what was it like? I see that you had, were you really good friends with Polly, I should say Polly, I'll say Polly Walnuts.
Tony Sirico? Tony Sirico, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I call him Polly Walnuts, but.
You know, one of the things that I have
scenes
to
say. Together.
Yeah. No, we were all very close. You know, we spent a lot of time together working, you know, sometimes, you know, 14, 16, 18 hour days. And, you know, a lot of times we would just say, hey, you want to go grab a drink or a bite to eat? Then we would go out after, you know, usually, I mean, look, if you're working with somebody that many hours, you just want to go home. You don't want to see anybody's face. But we genuinely liked being around each other, you know, and we did go out. As far as Tony Sirico is concerned, we would do a lot of charity events and appearances, different things like that. And Tony was always a part of it, and we were always together and always kind of like, you know, having a great time, basically. And one of the things I wanted to tell you is that we were all put in the position as celebrities to give back. And that's why you see a lot of us doing these different charity events, you know, and raising money for different causes.
Speaking about your acting career, go ahead, Michael, sorry. You have a follow up?
No. So on that note, what's an important charity that you're involved in?
Well, St. Jude's, for example, you know, children with cancer. I mean, they give money to the families. You know, that, I mean, they take care of it. They don't. The families don't have to pay a thing. You know, the March of Dimes. I've done. There was one time where Jim just kind of didn't like the spotlight a lot, and he was asked to do certain charity events and like speak up there. And so he would call me up and he's like, Federico, would you mind going there? Edie's going to be there. I just can't, you know, I just don't have the head for it. And so I would say, of course, man, I'll do it. And so there were several times where I was there with Edie Falco and, you know, we would be presenting and then, raising money for different causes, you know.
Federico, before The Sopranos, what were you most known for?
Before The Sopranos, I was knocking around, you know, as an actor for about 12 years. I was doing theater. A lot of I was with two different independent theater companies, you know, doing classic plays and, you know, modern, you know, just contemporary plays as well. I did a lot of regional theater, Shakespeare festivals. And then, of course, I got noticed doing a play by John Patrick Shanley. And an agent, you know, approached me and said, if you don't, do you have representation? I said, at the time I didn't, I was just getting stuff on my own. They said, we'd like to represent you. And they started sending me out and I started booking things right away, you know, like, soap operas and, you know, commercials, different things like that. Just, you know, getting work as an actor, you know, in New York City.
Interesting. Now, Michael, I got a question for you, Michael Motta, about Federico. Then you can ask another question. How many people recognize him when you guys go walking around places hanging out? Because you are good friends, too, in the time you've known him.
Yeah, I mean, every time we go out, I mean, again, I think The Sopranos just hits home with so many people in such a diverse group. I mean, you know, with the Sopranos con, obviously we're together a lot. We actually were chosen to do a documentary. So there's a documentary being filmed right now for the last 3 months called Don't Stop. It's the Sopranos con story, and it talks about the three partners that came together because our theme is for the fans, by the fans, and how we put this historic event on. And Federico was actually chosen as the narrator. So we're often out and about, you know, grabbing something to eat. And you know, it's funny, I'll tell you a quick story. We're in Providence, Rhode Island. I can't even remember the time. Time just goes by so fast. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were in a hotel. It was around 11 o'clock. We went to the historic Haven Brothers, and we're standing there ordering some late-night food, and the guy's, like, looking at Federico, and I'm like, I think this guy knows who he is, so I'm going to play with him a little bit. So we ordered the food, and I said, you know who he is? He goes, I thought it was him. So pretty much that's how we get it all the time. I mean, Federico, obviously, he doesn't look like he aged much. I mean, he's still got the long hair, and, you know, he still looks very similar to what he did in the show. So it happens all the time.
That was a great story, for sure. But now, Michael, go ahead with the question, Michael Motta, for another question for Federico.
Federico, obviously I know, but I think...
How about a question about Sopranos Con?
All right.
We should be talking about that, man. This is an historic event.
Okay, go ahead.
So let's lead with that question. So Federico, Sopranos Con, biggest event in history. What do you think about it?
I think it's going to be an amazing event for so many reasons. People that love the show for many years finally get a chance to meet the characters that they love, that were in their homes, that were in, you know, they watched every Sunday night at 9 o'clock, you know, and there they are in the flesh. It's like, you know, it's like if I were, I mean, I grew up watching, you know, certain shows and if I saw like somebody from that period, you know, like Henry Winkler or somebody like that, you know, it sparks a memory and it sparks like a great feeling because, you know, you saw him as the Fonz, you know what I mean? And so it's like, it's almost like the same feeling, but this is going to be so much more because we're doing replicas of some of the sets. I don't know if Michael told you about that, but there's going to be the Melfi set, right? And it's being built to the T with all the, even the small, like, sculptures and things and artwork that's in that room. And it's going to be an escape room. You know, people are going to go in there and just, like, chill. And then we've got the Bada Bing set. Then there's going to be the Halston set. Seriously. And, you know the very last booth that Halston's, of course, it's the very last scene of the series, where they're eating the onion rings. They're in a place called Halston's. It's in New Jersey. It's in, I believe, in Nutley, New Jersey. And they built the exact booth. Halston's is one of the sponsors, and they're going to be there, right, Michael?
Yes. So they'll be providing the onion rings. People will be able to sit down in the booth, take photos. We're going to have the iconic Pine Barrens, which was, people are saying, the best episode that's ever happened on any TV show. That's going to be a maze. Pai Oh My, if you remember Pai Oh My from the show, which Tony falls in love with the horse.
Oh, I remember
Pai
that.
Pai Oh My is going to be there in the stall. Yeah, we're going to have, we're flying in a painter from Brazil who's going to actually be painting a 20-foot by 20-foot mural of Tony Soprano. We're going to have memorabilia. Wow. We actually have the white Cadillac Escalade truck signed by James Gandolfini, Tony Soprano. That's going to be there. We have a feast. It's going to be like the Feast of San Gennaro. So as you travel into the expo, we want you to feel like you're traveling into the show. So you're actually going to go through the Lincoln Tunnel, pay your toll, and you're going to go in and you're going to see the feast. You're going to see different paintings, different artwork. Again, all of the things that Federico just mentioned. And then on top of all that, you're going to be able to see 52, at least. We're up to 52 as of today. I'm actually working on 53 right now, cast members. So these are cast members that some of them played from every episode, and you're going to have some that just played a few minutes in an episode, and you're going to be able to talk to them, meet and greet, red carpet, get autographs, get selfies. Uncle Junior, Dominic Chanace, which everybody knows him, he's flying in. He lives overseas, but he's flying in. He's going to be singing both days as well as doing autographs.
Oh, my.
Alabama 3's from London. You'll know them. I mean, the name is sometimes difficult to connect, but at the beginning of every episode, the opening credits is Alabama 3, Woke Up This Morning, Grabbed Yourself a Gun. Everybody knows it because we've heard it so many times. They're flying in from London, and they're actually going to perform both days with the cast members on the stage. So it's a very experiential type event. It's an unconventional con, and we like to call it the unconventional convention. It's hugely experiential. We want people to come in, spend time, feel as if they're part of the show. We have on-location tours where they'll go and take you to different places in New Jersey for a two-hour tour during the event,
wow,
where you'll be able to visit the real Bada Bang. So there's a lot of different things that went into this. This truly is for the fans, by the fans. And I can tell you this, I've been entrenched in this for a while now. It's been, you know, a few months since January, really, that we've been getting this thing together, and people are coming from all over the world. I talk to people from Australia, the Netherlands, London. People have got, we've sold out 4 hotels already. It's just a true passion. You know, it's a community. You know, it's more than just a TV show. It's more than just an event. It truly is a passion. You know, when you pull on the heartstrings of people and give them something that they love. You said you're a professional wrestler. Obviously, people love wrestling. People just love The Sopranos, the way it was filmed, the way they connect, the way the cast members are. So I feel the same way, to be honest with you, with the cast. I talk to the cast every day. Federico was just talking about Sophia Milos. I just shared a video about 10 minutes ago. I probably talked to her about 8 times today. Kathleen Carducci, she actually is a big part of the show. She was married to Artie Bucco, and they had the Subios. She's in The Irishman.
Oh, yeah.
I talked to her about 10 times today. Yeah. So these people all are coming together for the first time in history. You know, and one of the things that I laugh about is, you know, even Federico, a huge part of this mega show, hasn't met some of the people that are going to be at the convention.
That's very true. You know? Yeah.
Because they didn't, didn't work timing-wise. They weren't
together. Well, yeah, because you have to think about it. When there's an episode, like, okay, out of 13 episodes, you might do 11 or 12. You're slated for a guaranteed 11.
Right.
So in some of those other episodes, there are actors in there that worked in there that will be at the Sopranos Con that never met me and I never met them, which is going to be kind of cool, you know, that we were on the same series and then we're finally going to meet. And of course, you know, the fans are going to, they're going to love that as well. But, you know, going back to the partners, I wanted to talk about the partners,
for sure,
which starts with Michael. Michael, like I said, he's an entrepreneur. He's a straight shooter. I mean, he knows exactly what he wants. And, after meeting Dan Trader, who is like a specialist with memes, you got to see what this guy's putting together, man. I mean, and he's got an incredible following, and they're mainly related to Sopranos, like Sopranos memes, and some of the things that he's done. I mean, I literally bursted out laughing, and the person who is building all the sets and doing all the signs and really kind of creating the look of this entire con is our friend Joe Fama. He's amazing. This guy is an artist through and through. And, you know, I just can't wait till this whole thing comes together. I saw the floor plan. They showed it to me. It's a little vague, but when they started showing me, when we went to Joe's factory or where he's building everything, it really all of a sudden started really coming together and saying, I said to myself, this is going to be an experience that everyone is going to want to be a part of, and they're never going to forget it.
And so I've already found out Federico is the same as Furio. There you go. How you go ahead and get us to get Michael to do another question. You are as intense as you say you are. Well, if we met together and you saw my 6'10", 300 pounds. Now I'm down to 290. Okay, I've lost some weight. So, but meaning my intense pro wrestling.
Not bad.
290. Yeah. 290. I'm dropping. I got to get back. I'm trying to drop some weight again. I'm getting older. 46. I'm a former professional wrestler, Michael. You're already trying to put me back in the ring. That's not happening. Unless somehow there's a. Unless it's again, I'm going to be wrestling Furio at SopranoCon. That Sopranos Con. Hey, then, hey, we're already putting it out. Get the ring out and everything. And then somebody will have to. To
hey,
do something.
If it's for charity, I'm up for it, man.
You don't get me started with my promoting stuff. I'm a promoter just like Michael in so many ways. Now, so let's talk Federico real quick.
Hey, if you're six,
yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was gonna say if you're 6'10", you gotta be ducking, man. You have to be ducking through doorways.
Oh yeah, Chappie yeah, remembers that, right? Chappie, you remember the days when I had to duck through? For sure. Michael's Chappie's a pretty good size too. Oh, let's go last. The question I want to go to Federico is life after The Sopranos. What did you do? Did you leave acting, or did you go on to something else? Sometimes, it's, tell us about that.
What wound up happening is that The Sopranos was an incredible springboard for everybody, pretty much on the show. I mean, you had actors from all over the country, all over the world that wanted to be on that show. It was probably the best show in the history of television. And so after that, people knew my work, people in the industry knew my work, even like really famous actors. I tell the story a few times. I was in Canada. We were doing, in Toronto, Vinny Pastore and I were doing some kind of like press junket for HBO at the time for the new season. And I have relatives that live in Toronto, and I was going to lunch with my uncle. He comes to pick me up. We're walking away from the carport from the Four Seasons, and I hear Vinny calling me, "Hey, Federico, come back here. So as we're going back towards him, I see him standing there with a guy, and as I'm getting closer and closer, the guy is looking more and more like Burt Reynolds. And I'm like, I get up to him, and he's like, "Federico, Burt, he wants to meet you." I'm like, "What?" I said, "Burt Reynolds, you know who I am?" I mean,
wow.
It's crazy. I've watched everything you've done, man. So it was mind-blowing knowing that people that you've admired and looked at their work, and they're huge stars, and they know who you are. They know your work and complimenting your work, which is, that was just an incredible feeling. And I had that over and over when we did the Screen Actors Guild Awards on the red carpet. People would come up to us. And even at the Emmys, the Emmy Awards, it was just, and you see everybody, all these faces that you've been seeing for years in film and television. And they're coming over to you saying, "Hey man, I love your work. I love your work. Whoa, thank you, man. I really appreciate it." Some of them, they had to tell me who they were because they were in television shows that I had never watched, But it changed in a sense that people know your work.
Right.
I wound up getting a lot of work after that. It was a lot easier to get into a restaurant. You get a table, no problem. And still to this day, it's kind of the same. I mean, people still recognize me all over. I mean, as far as acting, yes, I still act quite a bit, in different films, mainly films. I've been directing since 2006. So I've directed a bunch of films which were mainly shorts and some commercials, but the very first feature film that I directed called The Brooklyn Banker is viewable now on Amazon Prime. So
really?
There you go.
Oh, well, okay. I'm watching it. Again, I'm this big streamer working all night doing my social media and my entrepreneurial businesses. And that's awesome. How I watch all the different Sopranos. And so I'll have to definitely look out for that for sure. Go ahead, Michael, with the question. Sorry, Federico, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we have in my film, The Brooklyn Banker, we have around four or five actors from The Sopranos. David Proval played Richie Aprile, Arthur Nascarella. I forget his character name. We have also John Bianco that was in it, and a couple of other guys. So, yeah, there's you might see some recognizable faces from The Sopranos in my film.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
And Paul Sorvino, but he wasn't in The Sopranos.
Okay. No, but that's a great big name for sure, Federico. Go ahead with the next question, Chappie, for either Federico or Michael. Go ahead.
So, well, this one's for Michael. So, when you said you got all these sets and stuff together, did you pull, or were you raising funds or just using your own funds to get this thing off the ground?
Great question. So, you know, it's funny. I'll tell you a quick story, and then you'll have to watch the documentary to get the rest. But when we first got together, again, I'm a marketing guy. I did all the marketing for a company called Alex and Ani. That's my passion and love, and that's what I do best. And when Dan Trader had made that call to me and said, you know, can you help us put on an event? And I realized that he had such a huge following on social media. Obviously, the bell started ringing in my head that this could be something huge. So what we did was, I hadn't even met the guys before, Joe or Dan. We had one conference call. We agreed that we all would work together. I told them that I had access to the cast members and the gift of gab is a specialty of mine, that I'd get some people together. We put a website between the three of us together. We launched it. We didn't even have the facility. I had made a call to the venue just to get some ideas of how much it would cost. And I said to the guys, listen, we're going to test the waters. We're going to launch a website. We're going to talk about the day. Let's pick the dates. We did. We put Federico. I want to say we had Vincent Pastore because we had worked with him in the past. Pai Oh My the Horse, I believe. So it was very, very, very basic group of folks that we were going to launch with. And we hit the launch button. And at that point, we were all prepared to obviously put money in as we needed. But the ticket sales started coming in. This is February. So once we did that, I went away for a few days and I noticed the sales and we had enough to put the deposit down and the rest is history. It kind of just snowballed into this great event that people have just been in love with since the day we launched it. I think people have been waiting for this thing called Sopranos Con, one way, shape, or another. Again, 10 years, Dan has had this group of people that, you know, eat and sleep Sopranos. Like if you go on, you know, the Facebook pages, you'll see them make comments, the memes. It's just, it's so organic. And you know, there's an old saying, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And it truly is true. I mean, we've been grinding, let me tell you, for the last 6-7 months to get this thing together, but it's been so much fun. You know, and I think all of us have that same passion. So when we say for the fans, by the fans, we're not kidding. It truly, truly is. And when you think about that, Federico's a fan of The Sopranos, you know, even though he played such a big part before he even got in, he was a fan. And when he left, he was a fan. So if you put us all together and we all have the same passion, that is why this has gone so big. I'll tell you another quick story. Our lawyer at the beginning reached out to us. He's from, to be honest, I can't even remember, Minnesota or something like that. We've never met. We had conference calls, and he donated his services. And that's gone and happened many, many times over where people have just donated their services. I've been just reading an email a couple minutes ago while Federico was talking about someone who wants to volunteer their time because they have such a passion. Sundays have never been the same without The Sopranos. We get those stories like every day. I can't even tell you, like, the phone dies 4 or 5 times a day because the amount of text messages, phone calls, Facebook messages, it truly is a passion for so many people. And, you know, so to answer your question, yes, we were prepared to put our own money in. We did not raise any money from any funding sources other than we just put tickets on sale and we just ran.
Wow.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm surprised you guys didn't Kickstarter something.
No.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, we considered it at the beginning.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, the day we launched the ticket sales, it just started to explode. So, you know, again, with anything else, you know, if there's a demand, you know, you come up with a supply, we got it.
Right.
All right, so Federico, when you knew you were going to be written out of the show, how did that feel?
It sucked.
That's a great answer.
I knew that was coming.
Oh, man. Well, you know, you take it like a man. Some people didn't. But you know what? It's a mob show. People come and go. And, you know, I would have, obviously, it's an incredible experience. And, you know, you always want to kind of go with you know, you don't want to, like, leave it too soon. But it's the way it was written, you know, and for many different reasons. And sometimes it comes down to financial reasons as well, that, you know, where they bring in new characters that cost a lot, and certain ones have to go. Some people that were supposed to get the short straw, like the storylines changed. There was another character that was supposed to go. I'm not going to mention it on the air, but the storyline changed where they needed that character. And so somebody else had to get the short straw, and it was Furio, unfortunately.
And were you surprised you didn't get killed? Because of most of the main...
Well, yeah, no, I had every... Yeah, no, I kind of knew early on what was going on because I spoke with Terry Winter, who was actually not only writer-producer, but he was the one who created my character. And we always had a great rapport. He went on to create Boardwalk Empire. And so I spoke to him early on, and I said, look, does Furio get this? You know, and I gave him the sign of the gun. Does he get killed, you know? And he goes, no, it's not going to happen that way, he said. So I knew, like, from the beginning of the fourth season that Furio was going, and he wasn't going to get killed. And so when I got the call later on in the season from David Chase, because everybody that would either get whacked or, you know, was getting written off the show for whatever reasons, you know, David would give him a call and they would have a chat with him. And a lot of times they were like begging him not to get rid of them. I've heard so many different stories like that. But we had a great conversation. He says, I don't want to kill the character. You never know, Federico. We might bring Furio back. So that was kind of cool.
It seems like it. And it seems like, again, the experience was amazing. But that's a great answer to it. And I guess I guess I would want to be killed instead of what happened to you. But because some of the big stars that got killed, unbelievable stories for sure. Chappie, one more question for either of them, and then we're going to have to let them go. But go ahead with the question, Chappie.
Okay. Furio, so... I saw
yes,
that you,
Chappie. How can I help you, huh? You called me Furio. I responded.
You did a lot of Broadway
Furio
plays.
And it was Furio language.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been a long time. I used to know it.
I'm just messing with you, man. Go ahead.
I know. It's funny. So, did you enjoy plays, doing plays?
Broadway. Did I enjoy doing plays?
Broadway.
Immensely. Yeah, immensely. Plays, doing a play as opposed to, you know, shooting a television series or a film, two different things altogether. I mean, when you're doing a play, it's very immediate. I mean, you've got the audience response right there in front of you, and you feel it. You feel, you know, when you're doing great. And when you're not, you know, when you're shooting a film or a television series, sometimes you're shooting things out of sequence, and it's, you know, you're not as projected as well. When you're on stage, you know, you're projecting with, you know, through your diaphragm. You know, it's just basically, you know, getting your voice out there. You know, there's someone, I forget who it was. It was a famous teacher, but anyway. They always mentioned that there were two different real life. There's real life on stage and real life on camera. Real life on camera is very subdued. It's very toned down. And on stage, it's brought out more, you know.
That's a great answer. And I always hear people when I talk to so many actors I've interviewed that they love being to do plays on stage. And there, and I remember in pro wrestling, again, it's a lot of impromptu. We're not, you know, it's not a huge script, except now Vince McMahon is making it the biggest thing of all scripted everything, which is too bad. And I, again, I love the fact that of the days in pro wrestling when I was in it, guess what? It's impromptu. You decide what you're going to do based on the crowd's reaction. And if the crowd doesn't react a certain way, same thing almost in plays in a lot of ways, that you have some, you're live. So it's all about you and how your performance is and how they respond in that performance.
Exactly.
Compared to 55,000 takes and there you go.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Television, film, you have many different takes, on stage. It's, you're out there alone on a wire. It's almost like, someone, you know, doing walking on a wire, you know what I mean? You can fall off at any point.
All right, Michael, best place we can find information on Sopranos Con and stuff. Where can we go to purchase tickets and everything? And are you going to be sold out at one point, Michael, if it continues the direction it's going?
Yeah, great question. So it's SopranosCon.com. Get any information on the cast members, tickets, and what kinds of things are going to happen. As far as are we going to sell out, I believe we are. We're trying to encourage as many fans to get their tickets ahead of time. Typically, people wait until the day of. You know, I've done a lot of events in the past, and you'll find 70 to 80% of your people will wait until the day of, because either it be they don't know what they're going to be doing, or just they just think they can get it at the door. We certainly will be selling tickets at the door if they're available. So I hate for people to miss it just because they waited. So if people can get on the website, shoot us an email at SopranosCon@gmail.com with questions. We're happy to be answer them. You know, there's going to be panel sessions. There's going to be so much to do. If you're a Sopranos fan, this is where you need to be. SopranosCon.com, November 23rd, 24th, Meadowlands Expo Center. We'll see you there.
And Federica, where you are you on social media? People can connect with you and stuff and learn more about you?
Yeah, well, very little social media, but you know, I do have a website which shows my paintings. It's FedericoCastelluccio'sPaintings.com and then Twitter, of course.
You guys are fabulous, and I have a great idea for Sopranos Con to continue promoting it on the Neil Haley Network and Neil Haley Show and all the conglomerates I'm trying to build. And I love this. I got to thank Amazon. I think it was the one that I streamed everything on Amazon. So I'll give the plug to Amazon that you got to listen, watch all of the Sopranos. And again, I'm a fan of Amazon and the fact that they bring back the older shows so people can watch shows that they never got the chance to watch, especially on HBO. So thank HBO, thank Amazon, and thank this opportunity. And it was a phenomenal experience. Appreciate both you guys calling and a great show. And we'll be in touch very soon to continue to have guests. They're going to be part of Sopranos Con all the way leading up till the event. So I appreciate you guys calling.
Awesome.
Thank you
so much.
Take care. Thanks, guys. Okay. It was great talking to all of you.
Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to Neil Haley's show. We'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show on the Author's Corner segment, Miami Book Fair, November 17th to 24th. The Street Festival is the 22nd to 24th. Go to miamibookfair.com for more information. It's finally getting chillier. I just anticipate the next couple of weeks. And then where's the best place to go? Go to Miami. Get away from the cold, the snow, everything about winter, and enjoy Miami. Enjoy the great book festival and enjoy the amazing authors. And we continue to have great authors on the program leading up to live. I'll be broadcasting live in Pittsburgh while my co-host will be in Tampa, Florida. Neither of us will be in Miami, but it'll be our 10th year. We've covered the Miami Book Fair live. I'm excited to welcome the program author Boris Fishman, author of Savage Feast, Three Generations, Two Continents, and A Dinner Table, a memoir with recipes. Boris, thanks for calling. How are you?
Hey, Neil. Thank you for having me. Good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Let's go really quickly to specifically enough. Will this be your first time in Miami?
Oh, no. I almost live there, even though I don't. The best way to live in New York is to live in Miami. I feel like sometimes it's the sixth borough. I've visited dozens of times by now over the years, and actually it'll be my second time at the book fair itself. So I've been there many times.
Oh, wow. Okay. And as a participant, or as just to be there, just to check it out?
As a participant, I was there for my first novel, which came out in 2014. It was called A Replacement Life. It was about World War II and the Holocaust.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So let's go. How did you decide to become an author? Tell us the story.
Oh, I think it decided me, you know. I did my best to try to do something else because it's such an unstable career. But for whatever reason, and I think I know the reason, which have a lot to do with the way you grew up, it was just, I wanted to express myself on the page. And shortly after graduating from college, I ended up at the New Yorker magazine working in their research department. And that was sort of the beginning of my writerly education. And as much as I appreciated what that place taught me, I wanted to pick my own subjects and I wanted to write rather than research. And so I just struck out on my own, and eventually that brought me to a graduate writing program. And that's where I began to write my first novel.
Wow. And then from there, trying to get published is the challenge, right? After you write your first novel.
Oh, God. I guess, all in all, 4 or 5 years, several of which were spent writing and several of which were spent trying to get agents to agree to represent me and pitch me to publishing houses. A lot of no's, years of rejection, redrafting, trying again, trying to keep faith, trying to keep money in the bank because this certainly wasn't bringing in any. So it was a very long journey.
And that
I was going to say that and it doesn't end just because you've published a novel. Every new project is, it's like with a movie, even though you've had a success, you still got to find new investors for the new one. And so it continues to be a challenge. It's just not an easy way to make a living in America in 2019.
I wonder if book agents are like the Hollywood agents. It'd be very interesting to see it and how they pitch different people and pitch different in the decision-making process. Just finished going back and watching all of Entourage on Amazon.
Uh-huh.
And I laughed my butt off in the fact of the way Hollywood works. And I'm sure that the book world works almost the same way. And just what they think is going to work and what's going to sell and find the right agent that's going to really go to bat for you.
I think that's right. I think there's a spectrum, right? And like maybe a good analog is like if you go to Canada, they have liberals and conservatives too, but their conservatives are way more liberal than our conservatives. So to transpose that to the book versus film agent spectrum, they're all interested in selling the product and making money, but probably even the most business-minded book agents are slightly more art-minded than their equals in the film world, right? Like with book agents, the reason that I love my agent, for example, is that he cares equally about art and commerce. We talk about the artistic side of the project, but we also talk about its prospect in the market, and I want to do both of those. There are certain book agents who are not really going to spend a lot of time editing you or giving you artistic advice. They just care about making the sale. That's why they're there. But even those, I would venture to say, got into this business rather than, say, the film business because they care about books, they care about art. They're going to be slightly less mercenary, even in those cases.
Absolutely. All right. So let's jump from there really quickly to the book and why you're writing.
Yeah.
2014 was, so it's been a few years, right? 2014.
I had a novel in the interim. I had a second novel come out in 2016. But, you know, I started in journalism. I love nonfiction. I wanted to get back to it. And then this idea crept up, which was a family history told through recipes, a nonfiction family memoir told through recipes. And I contemplated telling it as a novel. But honestly, the real stories were so wild that even though there are many things about it that feel like a novel, the dialogue, the characterization, the narrative arc. It's a novelist memoir. But that said, you know, I come from a country where things worked in some really surreal ways. By that country, I mean the Soviet Union.
Right.
And there were just so many great stories to tell about my elders and the kinds of adventures they got into and the kinds of dangers they faced and the many ways in which food, which is like food plays a big role now in American life. It's like the new religion. It's, you know, everybody's thinking about it, what to cook, where to eat, artisanal this, farm to table that, chefs are rock stars. But it's a mainly consumerist phenomenon. Whereas in the Soviet Union, food was essentially currency. There wasn't enough of it to go around. And if you had access to good food, then you could have a lot of things that you couldn't otherwise obtain. And so, and my grandfather on top of it was just a really skilled, resourceful black marketeer who knew how to use this currency to get all sorts of things that he wanted and that he thought my family should have. But he got into lots of really interesting and dangerous scrapes along the way. And so I kind of wanted to profile both aspects of that story, both the food and the danger.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You think about specifically enough that country and the history and what they've gone through and the ups and downs of where their political movement's going and culture and everything changes that have happened in that country and even today. It's really, really confusing and challenging for the people living there.
So, I mean, in the United States, we've lost our understanding of what it means to live without constant access to food. Right. And in the Soviet Union, it's a perennial subject. During the war, you have a literal blockade of what used to be called Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, for 1,000 days or so, where just people eventually resorted to cannibalism. And I don't mean to get into anything tawdry. It's just that, like, you have to understand what going largely without food for 1,000 days does to a people's psyche. And then all the shortages and rationing after the war. And it really, there's an arc that connects it to this very day. When we imposed sanctions on Russia after they invaded Ukraine, after they annexed Crimea, rather, right? They basically no longer have access to all sorts of products from Western Europe and elsewhere that they had access to until then. And it's doing all sorts of interesting things to their sort of food production ecosystem. They're having to develop proficiency in all sorts of things that they used to rely on other countries for, certain things they're not succeeding with, right? And they're just generally doing without. And so just this selective and unguaranteed access to food is just a huge part of the Russian experience that we in America don't understand at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite an interesting thing that we just don't know about. What if we go hungry? What happens if we don't have food that day, or we have to scrounge to something? There are people living like that in the United States, but not as many as Russia. That's for sure.
Oh my God. There are actually quite a few people, but it's the invisible affliction in America. Yes. It doesn't really get talked about.
It doesn't
faze
the people that are dealing with it every day. That just, you know,
every day.
Every day, they know about it. They understand it. And so yeah, for sure.
And that's another part of my book, because my grandmother, she's a Holocaust survivor. She spent 10 months during the war wandering around the swamps and forests outside the city where we lived, hiding from the Nazis. And she survived on basically potato peels and berries and sucking on tree bark and things like that. And that does things to a person's psyche. After the war, she was just plain old crazy on the subject of food. Like, she would not accept a job anywhere after the war. And you understand, everybody accepted whatever job fell to them. She would not accept a job after, unless it was at the bread factory. She was obsessed with bread. She wouldn't let my mother stop eating. She got so anguished when I didn't want to finish something on my plate when I was a boy. When she stepped out of the room, I would tiptoe to the window and scoop my huge bowl of oatmeal onto the bushes below, because I just couldn't eat as much as she wanted me to. And so it reverberates to this day. I live in New York City in 2019. Right. And it's so funny to me that we live in a time when so many people are trying to conserve and be eco-conscious. At the same time, there's such a tremendous culture of waste in America. Something like 40% of the food in our fridges gets thrown out before being used. And the way in which I am my grandmother's grandson is, every single week, 0% of the food in my fridge ever gets thrown out because it wasn't used as part of some meal. I'm incredibly conscious of those things because that's